Welcome everybody, and I gather some people are going to come a bit later, and everything's fine anyway. You'll have seen I had a little bit of financial instability myself here, because I was trying to shave kind of a bit roughly, and I had some instability, but not a crisis. Okay, so today... Today the theme, as I put it on the sheet, is research and ethics, and I hope you'll find all that interesting. This morning we're talking about some research projects that I've been involved in, which obviously I'm telling you because I think they're of relevance to thinking about financial instability. This first session then, we're going to talk about research on commercial property prices. And let me just tell you how this started. It was quite encouraging, really, because I had sent an application to do research on commercial property to the British Grant Giving Agency for research, university research, and they said, "Oh no, this is not interesting." So I emailed the BIS, where I'd got some old friends anyway. And they said, "Yeah, of course, we'll sort something out, and we've got all the data." And basically, I ended up doing two really nice papers with a friend called Hai Bin Zhu, who's now, I think, in their Hong Kong office. And both of these papers have got in. Well, the first one is almost in a top journal. The second one is in a top journal already. But obviously, the reason I'm giving them to you is not because they're in top journals, but because I hope that they're of interest, hello, to studying financial instability. The first paper is what we call a macro paper, and the second paper is what we call a micro paper. So in that sense, the first one is kind of macro-prudential, but the second one is also of relevance to macro-prudential, but I hope the second one is also interesting to bank supervision as well, directly. This is the first paper, it's revise and resubmit for Journal of International Money and Finance at the moment. So, basically our background, and this is what motivated me as well, is that commercial property and financial stability tend to go hand in hand historically. Especially you can think of the Japanese banking crisis that I told you about. That was very much to do with commercial property and not residential. All the Nordic banking crises in Norway, Sweden and Finland were all linked strongly to commercial real estate. And there have been crises, the Asian crisis as well of 1997 was also linked to commercial property. And although this crisis has so far been maybe more characterized by problems in residential property, I do think that there are serious problems on the horizon from commercial property. And there was an article in The Economist last Friday which did very much emphasize that the banks think that they're finished but with the crisis, but commercial property is lurking as prices have fallen of these projects very sharply. There's a need for rollover. Will the rollover actually occur? So what is it about commercial property that makes it so dangerous for banking sectors? Commercial property is likely to be more volatile than residential in terms of willingness to default, but also in terms of prices. And an important reason for that is there's no intrinsic reservation value. What we mean by that is the reservation value is what you would want to give to it, even if you couldn't sell it, if you like. So if you're a household, you want to live in your house anyway. So your house has got a reservation value. You're going to want to keep paying the mortgage just because you want somewhere to live. But if you're a company that's financed an office block or a shopping center, then there's no reservation value. You are not interested in it except as a source of profit. And then there's the key role of banks in financing commercial property. We saw in Japan, for instance, how they switched to commercial property from industrial lending. That was also true in the Nordic banking crises. But commercial property goes much wider because non-CP lending, like an industrial firm borrowing to build machines and things, they might well collateralize it on their buildings, okay? So much wider use as collateral as well. The factory buildings, the land might be used to collateralize loans for what looks like non-commercial property purposes. And there's been not much evidence on the link from the CP cycle to the credit cycle, especially internationally, and that's what we tried to rectify. Okay, and let me add that this was written, of course, before the subprime crisis, but we have data up to the early 2000s, which covers lots of other crises. So what's the explanation? Why does real estate bounce around so much? Firstly, the value of commercial property, just like any other asset, like equity, like bonds, is determined by discounted future rents. Okay, so a building is only worth the rent that you can get for it, and you would discount that using the government bond yield or some kind of bond yield. Investment, on the other hand, is going to be determined by what we call a valuation ratio. You will remember maybe from your university studies the thing called Tobin's Q. Tobin's Q is, or maybe from work you're doing here, Tobin's Q is the market value of the firm divided by replacement cost of capital. Okay. And there's an argument that that is a determinant of all investment by firms. If the equity value rises above the replacement cost, the market is saying you ought to go and invest and build up your firm. If it's below, it's saying you shouldn't. And you have a parallel to that with residential and commercial property especially, which is, you know, the value of the asset divided by what it costs to build it. So that's what I mean by valuation ratio. And there are distinctive features of the market, though. It's not like Forex, it's not like equities. And those features include, as it says here, heterogeneity, all buildings are different. There's no central trading of commercial property. Transactions costs are very high. You can't sell a building readily to somebody else. There are supply constraints as well. You can't get land immediately to build commercial property. And as we said, it's also used as collateral for bank loans, and external financing is needed for two different things. It's needed firstly for construction. The construction firm that builds a commercial property building needs money from the bank to do that. And then there may be a separate transaction whereby the completed building is bought by somebody who then uses it for renting out. And both of those are usually done by bank debt. Bonded finance is not so common for commercial property. So what does that mean? So what can we say then? You can have optimism in commercial property, and that can drive up the prices of buildings, right? So get people get excited about economic prospects for Estonia. You can, if you want to buy a shopping center here or something, or even a smaller real estate, then that will drive up the price of it in the same way as you would drive up the price of residential real estate when demand goes up. But the supply response is slow. This is the key thing. If the demand for commercial property rises, then it takes quite a while for any supply, starting from zero, to hit the market, okay? But the problem is supply response may be too great for the actual excess demand that we have in the first place. people, in other words, respond to an increase in prices by starting lots of new buildings, and by the time they're finished, maybe no one needs them anymore, or at least they're too many for the available demand. And, you know, in Norway, in Sweden and Finland and places in the early 90s, they were dotted with shopping centres and real estate that nobody really wanted. And Spain is today, it's residential as well, I know, but that's that sort of thing. And now, economists don't like this sort of thing because they think, why don't people understand that the market is like that, that supply takes time to come? Why don't they build just the right amount of buildings in order to supply the demand? And so the argument that there's irrationality is disliked, but it could be that that happens, and it's our guess actually that it does. And what it means is that people are basing the expected profitability of construction on current prices. Okay? So in other words, the price has gone up because there's economic growth, there's demand, and so people think, I can get that amount of profit from a new building as well. They don't think too much about the effect of the collective supply response on price. And that might be due to rules of thumb, myopic expectations, disaster myopia, all these ideas that people don't look ahead. So economists prefer to think that people are intelligent and they have what we call rational expectations. And they would argue, some of them, that it's not possible to have this sort of cycle and volatility if people are rational. But we would say, well, look, here are some features that might make cycles, even if you've got a rational market. One is this, that there's no short selling. You can't stabilize the market by selling a building that you don't have, for example. There's a positive, what we call an option value of investment. Some of you might have come across the theory of real options, that there's a value to the right but not the obligation to do something. That if you think there's uncertainty, then the thing might be worth something, it might not. That's another argument people make. Long leases and use of credit, again, might make for cycles even with rational expectations. We then have the financial accelerator, which I talked to you yesterday, and this clearly is very important. Remember, the financial accelerator is to do with net worth and borrowing capacity of individuals and firms. So basically, supposing commercial property prices rise across the economy, then that means everyone who owns a building can suddenly borrow more than they could before because of the financial accelerator, the net worth that they have increased, makes banks more willing to lend to them. And finally, there's risk-shifting behavior by banks. If banks think that the authorities will bail them out, they may be more willing to lend to commercial property, even though they know, or in their heart sort of thing, that there could be a risk there. So empirical work, as we say here, looks at the interaction generally between investment, rent, and prices. And we mentioned some of it before we go on to do our own stuff. What about the relation between property prices and bank lending? Now, the background is what I said earlier, namely that commercial property price booms often precede banking crises. So we want to probe a little more using the literature. That if you look at the paper, there's plenty of references. What sort of interactions there could be between property prices and credit. So various reasons why property prices could affect credit, in other words, rising property prices, if you like, engender more lending. And one is the investment channel, which is pretty straightforward. People want to build more buildings when the prices go up, and then they borrow from banks in order to do so. That's what we call the investment channel. The second channel is a wealth effect on the borrowers, which boosts credit demand. That's a demand side factor, saying you are better off as a company if you've got a building that's suddenly worth more. So you think, well, I'll go and borrow more. So that's credit demand. Then the banks themselves, we've got to remember this, the banks themselves own property, which is on their balance sheet. The buildings and real estate that banks own, their branch offices, head offices, etc., will get revalued when there's a real estate boom. And if that's done, then that could, in principle, boost the capital base of the banks, the difference between assets and liabilities, and that could increase the lending capacity of the banks. So the banks are involved in it, not just as lenders, but also as companies themselves. And then finally, as I said, the financial accelerator effect that makes lending pro-cyclical. The rise in prices makes the net worth of the borrowers rise, and that in principle increases the supply of credit because banks are more willing to lend to institutions that have got higher net worth than they are to institutions with a lower net worth. And that's especially the case if default risk is underestimated in the booms. And you'll have seen when I showed you yesterday the UK banking sector had very low losses just before the crisis of 2007. So if you believe, if you start believing that's the normal thing, which I'm afraid banks tend to do, then again, you'll be even more willing to lend to these things. Okay, what about reasons? What we're doing, you can see here, is we're saying, well, we've got commercial property prices and we've got credit. So we firstly said, what are the links from commercial property prices to credit? What we're going to now look at briefly is, why might credit affect commercial property prices? Could you have credit as the initial moving factor? So there are various possibilities for lending to affect property prices even before they've moved themselves. One is what we call liquidity effect, that there's more credit available. That allows people to consider construction projects that they might otherwise have not have done. So the fact, the amount of liquidity, credit availability, if you like, may lead people to consider that. And more generally, it may raise real estate demand because people have the finance to either start projects, but especially to buy existing buildings. Okay, because, as I say, what we can think of is several types of lending. There's lending to build, and there's lending to buy. Okay. Lending to build is to do with starting a new project, but there's also lending to buy. You get more credit availability, then you can go out and buy something that somebody else wants to sell, just in the same way as for housing lending. And so that's real estate demand. And you can see then that an increase in credit availability could lead to an increase in prices that way. But also there's the lending to build channel over here. And real estate supply, although it won't affect it in the short term because all you've got is a construction, will in the long run have a negative effect on prices, okay? Because, as we said, the new buildings will hit the market. Demand, presumably, is whatever it is. So the more buildings that are available, the lower the prices in the long run. But that takes time. So, yeah, just for the new people, like we're talking about the dynamics of commercial property markets, okay? So we think there might be a short-term positive effect of credit on demand, but a long-term negative effect of credit on supply. So the price rises in the short term when you get more credit, e.g. when there's financial liberalization, but in the longer term, the market starts to crash. And as I was just saying, the supply of credit will be boosted when banks compete, for example, after financial liberalization. And as in Japan, and I think in Scandinavia as well in the 80s, the lending will be directed to real estate if the high-quality borrowers will shift to securities markets. And as I said, that's what happened in Japan. The big firms that we've all heard of in Japan in the 80s stopped borrowing from banks because either they had so much profits they could just reinvest their retentions, or because they were able to access the bond markets. And all of this may be aggravated by moral hazard. If the banks expect the safety net to bail them out, they'll be more willing to lend lots on real estate. So that's going back the arrow from credit to commercial property. But there's a third possibility, and that's what we call common economic factors. So let's call it GDP, although it might be anything. Might we have an effect from GDP on both commercial property and on credit? And when we think about that, then it's clear that we might. Credit may be affected by shocks to GDP, might be affected by shocks to interest rates. Banks are more likely to lend if they think growth is going to be rapid or if interest rates are cut. So this arrow is clearly a correct one. Equally, if you get shocks to GDP and interest rates, then the commercial property market over here may also be affected. Okay, so we have to be careful when we attribute causality in this network here, because we might see commercial property prices rise, but we can say, well, is that due to credit? Is that due to GDP? Or is it something internal to commercial property? And that might affect the judgment we make as macroprudential supervisors or banking supervisors, in fact, as to whether what's going on is dangerous or not. Will the changing nature of finance affect the interrelation between credit and commercial property? We can argue that when it's financially liberalized system, then this link here from credit to prices might be less likely to apply than the link from prices to credit. And why is that? The argument is that if we've got a free market in credit, then the lending will what we call accommodate to the demand rather than being rationed, okay? So it's not like suddenly there's more credit available. It's rather when the demand goes up, the banks supply it. And equally, the prices themselves, like other asset prices, should be forward-looking. They should say, they should be taking into account what they expect the economy to do. So when financial liberalization takes place, what we should expect is that this link here should be stronger than that link there. It's more credit to commercial property should be less important than commercial property to credit. And certainly in the UK, in housing, house price equations, what we find is that the volume of mortgages was a significant determinant of house prices until liberalisation, but after that, it was much harder to find a mortgage effect on house prices. And that's the same argument as we've got here. We're saying that in a liberalized system, then the credit availability is whatever it is in response to the house prices. And the house prices are determined by supply and demand and expectations. But these are all hypotheses, right? And we're going to go on to test them with some macro data in a minute. What sort of empirical work is there? There are various country studies in places like Hong Kong. If you want to look at the paper, there's a link on the site of the interaction with the banking system and commercial property. Most international studies have used residential prices or mixed prices, and some very well-known work in that area is by Borio and Lowe at the BIS, who find that credit and an aggregate of asset prices, mixed prices, help us to predict banking crises. And that's quite an interesting piece of work from a few years ago. But what we found was, when we started this, no major academic project has looked at the empirical cross-country relationship. So that's what we are trying to do here. Are there any questions, by the way? Has there been a commercial property boom as well as a residential one in Estonia?
This is much more residential.
Yes.
As a third of there was a commercial real estate crisis in the northern countries.
Yes.
Maybe they learned the lesson, so they built up here a residential real estate.
Well, yeah, and now they're learning the lessons in residential. Well, one hopes that people learn, but in the UK at least, where we're supposed to have intelligent bankers, we had a commercial real estate crisis in 1973, and then we had another one in 1991, and then maybe we're having another one now. So some people start saying there's actually an 18-year cycle, which is kind of weird, but the 18-year is the banker's forgetfulness time. Yes, the old guys have left who remember it, and the young guys just make the same mistake again, which is kind of sad. Okay, so here's a model that we use, which is kind of illustrative, but hopefully helps, based on Carey and Wheaton. So we have N investors, we have properties valued heterogeneously with a distribution of FP. And then this is quite important. The banks have got a varying lending attitude over time. They're more or less excited about lending, which is exactly what we've seen in the subprime crisis. We saw W being very high, and suddenly it's very low again. And as I said earlier, we've got two different types of lending. We've got L, and L is this one over here. L is the lending to buy, okay? Bank lending function for investors. And then we've got the supply, K, of commercial property being fixed in the short run. You know, it takes time to find the land, it takes time to buy the land, it takes time to build the thing, it takes time to fit it out. So you can't change the supply of commercial property for quite a while. But it responds slowly, as it says there, in response to prices exceeding replacement costs. This is the Tobin's Q that I talked about earlier. We've got a separate lending function, and B is lending to build. And investment then depends on current commercial property prices, and that's for the argument that we made earlier, that people are partly irrational, but also they have various bank credit market imperfections. And also this bank capital effect, as I say, the value of banks' buildings affects their willingness to lend, for example. So what we end up with is a market demand function, which is this one. So demand, as you see, is a function of prices, but also availability of credit to buy existing buildings. And then the second equation gives us the capital stock adjustment, where this delta is the depreciation of buildings. And the third one is the real estate investment function. So this is new build down here.
Hi.
A new build, as you can see, depends on bank lending to build, which is your B function. And both lending to build and lending to invest depend on real GDP, Y. They depend on interest rates, I. They depend on current prices of commercial property, P. And they depend on the bank's willingness to lend, which is W. And what you can see here is that we've lagged the investment because it takes time. That's the whole point, if you like. And in the end, the demand for real estate has got to be the same as the capital stock in real estate. So D equals K to clear the market. So within that model, we can find a relationship between property prices and bank lending, which is the L and the B, in the sense that higher current property prices increase bank lending. That's in the first equation, right? Demand, the P rises, people want more borrowing. Equally, they want to build more in order to make a profit. From the credit side, the higher lending to buy, that's your L, for example, due to financial liberalization, and financial liberalization we encapsulate with a rise in W, banks' willingness to lend, increases current commercial property prices. So there's no new buildings in the short run, there's more credit, drives up prices. But as I said, higher B, more availability of credit to build, is in the long run going to reduce prices because there's more buildings hitting the market. Hello. And both of those are affected by the macro factors, which is GDP and investment. So we can simplify that to two equations and two unknowns, whereby the capital stock here depends on of buildings, depends on bank lending, and it also depends on the bank lending to buy, and it depends below on the bank lending to build. And so the unknowns from there are K and P. So we end up with three hypotheses that we want to test as we look at the macro relationship between bank lending and commercial property prices and GDP. That's basically an interest rate. So that's basically what we're doing here. The first one is what we call the collateral or financial accelerator hypothesis. And so what does this say? It says that rising commercial property prices boosts bank credit. And as I've explained already, and as you know, banks are more willing to lend to firms that have a higher net worth, higher value of assets relative to their liabilities. That net worth is boosted when the value of the buildings that a firm owns, which as I say could be an industrial firm, it doesn't have to be a retailer or an office necessarily, that will benefit. It also gives more collateral. If your value of your building goes up, you can borrow more for anything that you want. You know, it can be new machines or whatever. So that's the collateral or financial accelerator effect. Secondly, we have a liquidity effect, and this says that bank credit can have offsetting impacts on commercial property prices. So I won't go through all that again. In the short run, the investor demand, which is this lending to buy, new credit raises prices. New credit to the constructor, which is B, reduces prices in the long term. And then we've got the macro effect. The CPP adjusts to macro conditions, this thing here. The dynamic adjustment will depend on what kind of property market you've got. And what we're arguing, and I don't go through all the equations, that if the supply is more elastic than the demand, then there's an oscillation about a new steady state, okay, when GDP hits. If, on the other hand, the demand is more elastic than the supply, you may get an overshoot in prices, and that gradually returns to a new steady state. So the question is, what is the relative behavior of supply and demand? Okay, this all sounds fairly, how should we say, theoretical so far. So what we're going to do now is look at some numbers. What we have is data for 17 countries, which are most of the OECD countries. And this is data that the BIS have been collecting over a number of years. The data are on commercial property price indices, generally in the capital city of these countries. You know, it's the best data there is, but it's not perfect. It doesn't actually tell us about the whole of Sweden. It tells us about the Stockholm real estate market, for example. But, you know, there isn't really anything better than that. And our focus, as I said, is the interaction of real commercial property prices. So in other words, we divide them by the CPI, GDP, investment, real credit, again divided by the CPI, and real short rates, subtracting the inflation rate from the short rate. And most countries' true data is annual. The BIS make them quarterly, but we use the annual data because you don't get any benefit if there is not actually a quarterly path. And we test first about stationarity, and we get unit roots in all these variables. In other words, they're trended, except for the real short rate, which is what we expect. We hope the real short rate is not trended. Okay, so we're doing two exercises then in this first part. And I warn you, this is quite a long presentation because we've got two papers and this is only the first one, but I hope you find it interesting. Firstly, we estimate error correction models for commercial property prices. So we have commercial property on the left-hand side and we do a panel with GLS, cross-section weights, white standard errors. And the equations are on this table here. Which I hope you can look at on your books. Maybe it's not so easy to see from right over there. So what have we got here? We've got on the left-hand side, we've got some dynamic terms. The dependent variable is the change in the log of delta LNCPP. Okay, that's the dependent variable. And we've got the change in real CPP over CPI, okay, so it's real. We've got the change in real credit, the change in real GDP, the change in investment. We couldn't get real estate investment, it's just all investment. And then we've got our long run terms. So this is the error correction term, the lagged real CPP in levels, lagged credit, lagged GDP, lagged investment, and the short rate as well down here. And as you'll know, those of you who do econometrics or have looked, the nice thing about an error correction model is that it tells us about the short run with the difference terms separately from the long run, which is the levels terms. And so what is it telling us? What we're doing is for various subcategories of countries. We start off with all the countries, 17 countries. We do the G7, small open economies. We do bank and market oriented countries. We do crisis countries, the ones that had a commercial property crisis. We have crisis countries during 85 to 95. So this is, you know, Japan, Norway, Sweden, Finland, I think Australia and UK as well. And then we have all countries from 85 to 95. So what we're trying to find is whether there are differences between those subgroups and also what the dynamics of commercial property is. And one thing you can see immediately is that there's a strong relationship to economic growth. So commercial property prices rise at twice the rate of economic growth in the short term. There's also a short-term relationship with credit, which is somewhat smaller. It grows about the same rate as credit in the short term. That's the 0.75 and 1.78. and that implies, obviously this implies a very cyclically volatile market. It's going to be much more volatile than output itself. We have a significant error correction term. This is before the days of panel co-integration tests, but I think we would have passed them. What we've got though is a long-run positive link to GDP. So not only does it grow with GDP in the short run, but it also grows with GDP in the long run. And actually it grows somewhat faster than GDP in the long run. The long-run effect is this divided by that. But in the long run, we get the negative credit effect, okay? So we get a short-run positive credit effect and a long-run negative credit effect. And that's exactly what we think should happen due to the model. And just thinking about the market, more credit, more buildings, prices fall in the long run. And one funnier variable is this one. You get a positive short rate effect, which is not what you would expect immediately, because it makes lending more costly. But that sort of result has been found in many studies as well, because it's financial liberalization drives up real interest rates. That's the sort of argument. So that's the basic panel result for all the countries. And in terms of the subcategories, although there are differences, you can see that most of the next four country groups are not that different. There are some things significant, some places in the G7 it's investment rather than GDP, but you still get the negative credit effect. Still get the negative credit effect here for market oriented. The interesting one is this one, crisis countries 1985 to 1995, because look at these coefficients here. You have an incredibly high volatility and strong short-term relationship of commercial property prices to GDP and also to credit growth. And obviously that means in the upturn, the CPPs were rising four times faster than GDP, and equally when the downturn happened, there was the most enormous crash. And the same with credit. Credit was has a huge coefficient on it, and a long-term positive credit coefficient. But of course, this is only a short time that we're actually looking at. So that's telling us some stories already, it's telling us that there is a very volatile relationship. And there are lots of significant relationships as well that are interesting to look at. But doing that panel estimation is only half the story, because we really want to find the interaction, not just looking at it this way. All we've done so far is we've looked at these two arrows here, from GDP to property prices and credit to property prices. What we would like to know, though, is the relative effect of all these different things here. And we started off by doing what's called Granger causality. Those of you doing simple statistics will know that Granger causality just means, does a variable precede another variable? And what that did, roughly speaking, was we found commercial property prices tend to rise in advance of credit in 9 countries, but we had some reverse causality. But Granger causality doesn't tell you much, it's only bivariate. So we went on to do what we call a vector error correction model, which is tracing the full pattern of interrelations between the commercial property, bank lending, and so vector error correction. And we did that country by country. So what that does is basically it estimates equations for GDP, for investment, for commercial property prices, and for credit, including all the other three variables on the right-hand side. And it's a vector error correction model because it has levels in it, a VAR, which is a vector autoregression, vector autoregression just has differences in it. And we tested for Johansson co-integration before we chose between those. The argument is that the previous equations, although they're interesting, they hide some endogenous factors. If commercial property prices affect credit and they affect GDP maybe as well, even, it might go this way too, then we want to know about it. In order, whenever you do these VECMs or VARs, you have to choose what we call the recursive ordering. And we preferred to have an ordering which started with GDP, then commercial property prices, credit, investment, and short rates. So that's a question of what happens first within a given period. The GDP first and interest rates last, that's the lags in the transmission mechanism. You raise interest rates and it's only next period that GDP rises or falls. Investment after credit and prices due to supply lags, those are just the arguments for that particular ordering. And prices before credit because of collateral and stickiness. Okay, so what we end up with, these are the outputs of VECM models, are what we call variance decompositions. And a variance decomposition, very roughly, is saying, does the volatility of one series affect the volatility of another series? So it's a kind of causality relationship. It tells us whether a series is autonomous in some way or whether it's not autonomous. And we end up with 100% determination of the variance of a given series by all the others. And the line to look at here is the one at the bottom, the mean level. So the left-hand side is what, if you like, determines in a VECM sense the real commercial property prices. And what you can see is that 47% there autonomous. So, in other words, there's a self-determination, if you like, or at least a determination from outside the model for a lot of the commercial real estate. And after that, it's determined by GDP. So it's saying that this link is quite powerful. On the other hand, its average determination by credit is not very great. So this link is not so powerful, is what it's saying. And the others we don't need to worry about. If we look on the other hand at credit over here, we can see that credit is less self-determined than commercial property and is strongly determined by both GDP and commercial property. So credit is less autonomous than CPP. It's more affected by GDP, that's this arrow, and also by CPP, that's this arrow here. And the argument then is that the variance decomposition is consistent with external shocks and prices on credit as the main channel of influence. The other output from a VECM or a VAR is what we call impulse response function, which says that you shock a variable in the model and then you see what happens to the other variables after that. And you get these little patterns like this. We're seeing what happens when we hit commercial property prices. No, we're looking here at what are the impulse response of prices to credit. Okay. And you remember we talked about the idea that initially you might boost prices if credit rises and then later they go down. And you can see here for, say, Germany, Denmark, UK, US, you do indeed get a short-term positive effect that might go on for a while of credit on prices, but in the long run, a negative one. So that's consistent with our model, that the supply lags mean that initially you get a boom, but when the supply comes on board because of lending, you get a slump. What about prices to GDP? As we said earlier, it depends on the relative elasticity of supply and demand. And what you can see here is overshooting in quite a lot of countries like Australia. It seems to overshoot, then it comes back. On the other hand, there are certain other countries where you get oscillation, like in Germany or in Italy or to some extent in the UK. So that's showing us how prices in response to GDP may have different patterns, and that may in turn depend on the elasticity of supply and demand. And this is years, by the way, at the bottom, so we're talking 10-year effects. So the conclusions of the macro paper then, basically we gave you a theoretical model showing that cycles can emerge under plausible assumptions, and we get effects of GDP, interest rates and credit. And commercial property prices seem to be more autonomous, linked to GDP and influence credit. The causality seems to be mainly from CPP to credit. Include that means the collateral or financial accelerator effect is quite dominant. The liquidity effect is less so, maybe because of liberalisation. Both GDP and commercial property prices affect credit. So here's some policy suggestions that we had at the time, that it would be good to regulate the loan-to-value ratio if the bank lending is in danger of being part of this cycle, maximum loan-to-value ratios. And that's kind of comforting, because that's been a big discussion issue in the recent crisis for residential real estate.
The value of commercial real estate is different than residential.
Mm.
I mean, residential, you can take the market price, but there is a discount in the value of the cash flow.
Sure. Yeah, I realize that. I suppose when we think about commercial real estate, it's also to do with how much equity they raise in order to finance the building, say. And as you say, you can't be sure of what the exact LTV is, although you know you can get surveyors and experts to make some sort of estimate. But I guess the argument is against the sort of lending that has often happened in the past, when banks have virtually lent all that was needed to build a building or buy one. It's saying, look, we want you to put a certain amount of equity into this building, that then protects the bank against that amount of price fall before the loan itself is in negative equity. So I think that might be the way you would think about it. A second one is, given this is such a volatile market, and we'll see it even more in the second paper, portfolio limits on loan concentration, we should, and this is a kind of hobby horse of mine, I think that statistical authorities and central banks should gather data on lending to industrial sectors, okay? And most countries don't. The argument is that different industrial sectors have different types of volatility relative to the cycle. And I did an earlier paper at the Bank of England called Bank Credit Risk, which showed that it looked at provisions and write-offs of a UK bank over 20 years relative to about 20 industrial sectors. And the ones that were most volatile relative to the cycle, in other words, they had the highest write-offs but also the worst performance when the economy went down, were real estate investment, commercial real estate investment. So if we think in a sort of portfolio framework, then we should say to the banks, well, either you should charge a lot of spread on this stuff, or else if you're not intelligent enough to avoid it, then maybe we should be telling you don't concentrate in this area, because that's what banks have done. It's very alluring for banks to lend to commercial real estate, because they get lots of front-end fees, they get bonuses maybe because of the high value of the loan. There are all sorts of reasons why it's attractive. So the regulator needs to keep an eye on that. And also thinking about valuation methods, can we not stop people looking at current prices of real estate in evaluating new projects, but rather think about how real estate may, the market may be when the buildings that have been being built now or planned now will come on stream. Financial crises have been caused by real estate bubbles. I showed you that yesterday with our work at the National Institute. We had residential property prices as a strong and consistent determinant of banking crises. Further research elements of commercial property prices on bank profitability and also predictability of banking crises, which is something I'd still like to do at some point. I mean, besides lending to industrial sectors, what I think is needed is an interchange of information between banks, because commercial real estate has got a lot to do with location, right? Especially if it's a retail or a hotel or something like that. So, supposing you've got a crossroads here and someone is building a hotel, and there's no hotels in the vicinity, then that hotel could well be profitable, okay? But supposing that some other bank is financing somebody else to build a hotel here, and some other bank is financing somebody else to build a hotel here, then you can see that those are going to be disastrously unprofitable because there's too much competition. So, at a very micro level, interchange of information, this is going beyond what we've talked about here at a macro level. At a very micro level, the more that banks can interchange information on projects that they may be financing, the less volatile and the less losses they're going to make on these things. Because, you know, all three banks are going to end up writing off a whole load of that debt, whereas if it had only been one bank and one building, it might well have been profitable. Any questions there? Yeah?
Well, I'm still getting back into what I'm involved, but the question is did you include or did you include expectations at some stage of the analysis? Because expectation, when it comes to bubbles, then there is always where in some way the expectation component is present.
I suppose that the dynamics of GDP are generating expectations, but no, we didn't put them in explicitly. And, you know, it's kind of hard to do, I think. I suppose we could have done something like a little AREMA model of commercial property prices to get some sort of expected price that way. That would have been possible. But yeah, that's a thought. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to paper two. We might have a slightly late coffee break, if that's okay, because I think these ones are... it's worth spending a little bit more time on the first session than the second one. Okay, so the second one is a micro paper, and this has been published in Quarterly Review of Economics and Finance, which we were pleased about. And basically this is... I showed you a table from this yesterday. Needn't spend too much time on the intro, the market stuff is fairly similar. We have seen asset prices affecting bank lending and bank performance, and particular role of commercial property prices, and I'll show you a table in a minute about the differences in behavior and performance when commercial property is on an upswing and downswing. And macro work has been underway, like the one I've shown you, but a lot less micro work. So this is, we think, something helpful as well, and hopefully to bank supervisors as well as macroprudential people. And here's the research question. Does commercial property prices affect the lending decision, risk, and profitability of individual banks? Okay. We're not talking macro like the first paper, we're talking individual banks. And what this table shows, again, look at the average, is some radical differences in bank behavior in the up and down turns of commercial property. As it says at the bottom, the up and down swing are the years when the prices are going up or down of commercial property. So on average, bank loan growth is 4 percentage points greater when there's an upswing. On average, risk-weighted assets grow 5 percentage points faster. That's an interesting difference. Look, risk-weighted assets are growing faster than total assets. So banks are increasing their risk, is what that's saying. On average, the return on assets is greater, so banks may be fooled into thinking they're in a wonderful situation. And because only the Spanish are doing advanced provisioning, on average, provisioning is only half of the amount relative to net income during the upturn as it is during the downturn. And you can see some of the numbers there are pretty serious. If you look at Norway, 145.9% ratio of provisions to income. So they were having to provision more than their income on average during the downturn. But there's some other huge numbers as well. Japan 57%, France 58%, etc. And America as well, big difference too. And yeah, number of years on the right. So that's giving you a taster of what we want to talk about here. We're talking about bank performance and commercial property. And of course other things will have been going on at the same time. I mean, that those tables are telling us about the whole cycle and the whole of bank behavior. But we still want to know, can commercial property help us think about this stuff? So we're looking at 904 banks, 89 to 2002. The BIS have some wonderful statisticians who are willing to spend months splicing bank scope together. So that's what they did for us. And then we try to find out the impact of commercial property on behavior and performance. And we look at five things. We look at lending. We look at margins between lending and borrowing, return on assets, profitability, we look at bad debts, and we look at provisioning, those five bank performance indicators. And those are of obvious interest to all bank supervisors and central banks, I think. And we find that there are marked impacts on performance and behavior. Controlling, and that's really important, controlling for conventional determinants. I mean, any fool can estimate an equation which says commercial property prices is regressed only on lending, and it says, oh look, commercial property prices affect lending. What we try to do, of course, like everyone else, is to include conventional variables in these equations, so we're not just capturing something else's effect on the relevant variable, what you call omitted variable bias. And we argue that risk managers, regulators, and monetary policy makers should listen to this stuff. Okay, that's how many banks we've got across a number of countries. And these pieces of work, especially if you're in the macroprudential area, are well worth a look. I mentioned some of them yesterday. These are micro work like ours. It's our background, if you like, which give us the sort of control variables that are traditional in the literature. So mainly World Bank and IMF people actually, provisioning, profitability and margins, Spanish guys working on bad loans, Dutch guys working on lending. Those are some major international studies on micro bank behavior, and those are well worth a look. You can get the references in our paper. But what we saw was that those people didn't tend to include commercial property, partly because they didn't have the data. So there are some national data, national studies on Austria, Japan, Hong Kong, and the US, but no international studies. So our advance then is, it's the first international study on how commercial property movements affect lending and affect performance after we control for its macro factors, bank-specific factors, and country-specific factors. So we try and control for all sorts of things. And micro-level data enable us to look at the variation in effects across countries, and whether booms and busts are asymmetric as well. We can do various things with this data. And we're doing GLS mainly, which is just normal panel, but we also do GMM, which is called Generalized Method of Moments, which is a robustness check, testing for endogeneity and presence of a lag-dependent variable, for example. So what are our control variables? These are the variables that we think might affect bank performance separately from commercial property prices. Firstly, macro variables, growth rate of GDP, inflation and short rates, obviously. Banks will do better, make less bad loans, have less bad loans, etc. when economic growth is rising. On the other hand, higher real interest rates might reduce lending, it might increase bad debts, etc., etc. Then we have bank-specific variables, and as I say, these are drawn from those existing literature. Loan-to-asset ratio, which is an indicator of credit risk, if you like, how much lending. It's the inverse, if you like, of bank liquidity. Real loan growth, an interesting variable because rapid loan growth is often thought to generate adverse selection. The more you lend, the more dodgy your customers are. Capital strength, which we already talked about. Net interest margin and the size of the bank. Is there a difference between big banks and small banks? And the argument there is that a large bank may be subject to moral hazard because they think they'll be rescued. A small bank might well be more cautious than a large bank because they don't think they'll be rescued. And we have country dummies. And then with all those variables, we add in commercial property prices. The issue of endogeneity is worth mentioning because the basic result ignores any dynamic interaction between the variables. We don't have a lag-dependent variable initially. On the other hand, what we do is that we lag the bank-specific variables, so we argue that that will reduce endogeneity because, you know, we're talking about last period's loan-to-asset ratio affecting provisions or whatever. We put in the level of commercial property prices, but we argue that that is going to be exogenous to an individual bank because we're not talking country sectors here. We're saying a small bank or even a large bank in a country shouldn't itself directly affect commercial property prices, okay? So we think it's legitimate to include the level of commercial property prices in the equation. And our previous work that I've told you about suggests CPP is largely autonomous. And also, if we lag everything, we lose loads of observations. But we do include some robustness checks, firstly putting a lag-dependent variable in, and secondly using the GMM as another robustness check. Okay, so these are some summary statistics of the various variables. And you can see we've got a serious number of observations, even for the banks themselves, up to 6,000 observations. The one that was worst is the non-performing loan ratio. Lots of banks don't stick that in bank scope for some reason, or a certain number of them don't. And those are just mean, standard deviation, etc., just descriptive. And what you can see down here is different patterns of large, medium, and small banks. This footnote says 62 large banks, 76 mid-size, and 766 small banks. And I can't remember the exact cutoff. It's like a billion and $10 billion or something like that in the assets. So there's an awful lot of small banks here, and we have to take that into account. They might be different. What you can see here, for example, if you look at these means, is that small banks tend to grow more fast than large banks. They tend to have a larger loan to asset ratio, and the large banks will be holding more securities, interestingly. Small banks have a much larger net interest margin than large banks, and I think one reason for that may be that the large banks are more involved in wholesale business, interbank, etc., that has a narrow interest margin, while the small banks are only involved mainly in customer business, so their interest margin is quite wide. Yeah?
How do you measure the banks and those?
Good question. I think we carry on with the ongoing bank, if you like. I'm not quite sure. That's a good question, yeah. Obviously, that's not going to affect an awful lot of variables, but in principle, we could have a dummy variable for it. Of course, this is published now, so we're not going to change it. But it's a useful point for future reference. Thank you. I do think these are interesting, these numbers. Look at non-performing loan ratios. What it's saying is that large and medium banks have much bigger non-performing loan ratios than small ones. So that's immediately a suggestion that large banks are less cautious. It's in your books as well. Large banks are less cautious than small banks in terms of risky lending. And equally, small banks have a larger return on assets than small banks have a larger return on assets than large ones. So obviously, it's not going to be true for all countries everywhere. But I like those. I think those differences are really interesting. Okay, so this is, if you like, the basic result, and I've already talked you through one row, which is capital adequacy. So these are basically pooled equations with random effects as opposed to fixed effects. I think in the eventual paper the referee told us to do fixed effects, but it was pretty similar. And we've got five dependent variables. It's five sets of results. One is loan growth, and then it's net interest margin. So that's the difference between average return on assets and average interest rate on assets and average interest rate on liabilities. Non-performing loan ratio, we've got return on assets, and we've got provisions over total assets. The non-performing loans is a ratio of loans rather than assets. And just starting off with the macro variables, you can see that we're capturing things in a way that we'd probably expect. So for example, if GDP growth is faster, you get more lending, you get a wider interest margin, banks are able to increase their margin, which is nice, and they get a higher return on assets when the economy is growing. So that's all pretty obvious. And equally, when the economy is growing, growing, you get less non-performing loans and less provisions. So that's all in line with expectations that GDP growth is good for banks. But equally, when you think of a recession, all that goes into reverse. And during a recession, you get more non-performing loans and more provisions. Inflation, only the ones with stars are significant. Higher inflation seems to also reduce these, probably because it's a cyclical phenomenon. Higher inflation also raises the return on assets, which I think is due to the benefit banks get from zero interest current accounts. The higher inflation, the more profit they make from those. The interest rate, mainly in line with expectations, higher interest, although not necessarily, because a higher interest rate seems to lead to more loan growth, may relate to the cyclical pattern. You get a boom, the monetary policy is tighter, but still you get more lending. Higher interest rate, higher margin, higher interest rate, more non-performing loans, that's the sort of downturn thing. And interestingly, higher interest rates and lower return on assets. Those are the macro variables, then the bank specific ones. I won't go through everything, but you can see things like the loan to asset ratio. The higher the loan to asset ratio, the less the loan growth. That's in line with a portfolio behavior by banks. If the loan to asset ratio is already high, they're not going to want to grow their loan book even more. If, on the other hand, the loan to asset ratio is low, they're more likely to grow their loan book. That's a simple result there. In terms of, and other results we can talk about separately, in terms of loan growth, quite interestingly, it boosts the return on assets. So that the short run effect, at least, these are all lagged, by the way. And when loans are growing, it's in the upturn usually, so the non-performing loans and provisions are not very high. On the other hand, when you grow your loans, the net interest margin shrinks, and that suggests that you're trying to get more and more business and maybe not making such a good profit in the long run as you will do otherwise. The difference between this and this could relate to non-interest income, I suppose. Net interest margin. A wider net interest margin makes banks more willing to lend. A wider net interest margin is also related to downturns when we have more NPLs and provisions. And of course, it's in line with a return on assets going up. Capital adequacy we've already talked through. It was a shame it didn't have an effect on loan growth. That might have been interesting. The others we talked about yesterday. And this is a profitability variable that people tend to include when we estimate a provisions equation. These two are the dummies. So what are the dummies saying? They're saying that compared with all the other variables, smaller banks have got a wider net interest margin. Smaller banks, interestingly, compared with the other table, seem to make more, not have more non-performing loans and less provisions. But on the other hand, they tend to have a smaller return on assets. And the one we're really interested in, I've just gone through that for your interest, is this thing at the bottom, which we'll focus on from now on, which is the commercial property price effect. So what is this saying? It's saying that when commercial property prices are going up, banks are growing their loans faster. So that's consistent with the financial accelerator, etc., and collateral. When commercial property prices are rising, the net interest margin is shrinking. Banks are not raising their margins as much as they should do, perhaps. When commercial property prices are rising, we get less provisions and less non-performing loans. And of course, the opposite is true. When commercial property prices are falling, we get more provisions and more non-performing loans. And it's also geared strongly to profits as well. Yeah.
Can you comment on this from that this estimation results contradict your descriptive stats?
I think what I may be misinterpreting those. I'll check that in the break. Actually, I may be misinterpreting the dummies. I think what we see on the next one is the leveraged effect of the dummies. So we're leveraging these different variables on the size of the bank, okay? So we're saying, for example, small bank lending, this is saying, is less based on commercial property prices than the large bank, so that's changing the coefficient. Small bank lending, its profits are less geared to commercial property prices as well, okay? Its non-performing loans, on the other hand, are more related to commercial property prices, and so are its provision. No, wait a minute, I know, that's it. You've got to think of the sign of the original variable here, okay? So what this is saying, we've got a negative coefficient on this thing, okay? So when this says 0.04, it actually means that we add the negative to the positive to the negative, the small banks are less geared to the cycle, okay, of commercial property in terms of their losses than are the large banks. Okay, so I think that's it. And in terms of the dummies at the top, I think those may... We don't have the... Ah, yeah, that's it. I think you've got to look at the constant.
That's right.
Should be adding to the constant. It's saying the small banks have got a wider interest margin, but it is saying they have more non-performing loans. It's saying they have less provisions, which we didn't have in the table, and less profitability. Yeah, that's hard to see. I agree. But the main interest here, anyway, is these effects on of commercial property, and these are, in other words, additive or subtractive. And they're saying what these lines at the bottom here are saying is that small banks are less geared to commercial property than large banks are, because you add these coefficients together, they have a lesser gearing of their provisions, a lesser gearing of their loan growth, a lesser gearing of their non-performing loans, and a lesser gearing of their profits to commercial property than is true of large banks. So that's the interesting result here, that large banks are maybe shown here to be more likely to take risks than small banks are. And these are some robustness checks. One thing is we did real residential prices. We did the whole equations, but we're not showing the rest of the variables. We tried with real prices, and the results are pretty similar, all significant. We tried with equity prices instead, and there are some differences in sign. positive effect on non-performing loans. Insignificant on provisions. Our argument then is that equity prices are not a substitute for commercial property prices. Would residential prices be useful as well? They're a possible substitute again when you put them both together, but we note the larger effect of on loan growth of commercial property. On the other hand, residential does kick out the significant effect on non-performing loans, which is interesting. What about lags? If you increase a lag of commercial property prices, then that is significant, and nominal commercial property prices as well are significant. By the way, the previous results were on a real commercial property prices. Oh yeah, the one at the top is real residential prices, sorry. So that kind of bears out the pattern of signs that we've got and suggests that what we're doing is sensible. What we do here is the generalized method of moments, which is sort of fancy econometrics, just to see whether the results fall apart. And they are weaker, we have to admit, the effect on the net interest margin in, when we do it all in differences, what we call the difference GMM, with a lag-dependent variable, we lose one of the effects, but not the others. We still get a strong effect on provisions, on NPLs, on growth, and on return on assets, but not an interest margin. And the other thing you can do is what we call the two-step GMM levels, again with a lag-dependent variable. Lag-dependent variable being included as a robustness check, and the GMM to cope with the LDV's effect. Again, most of it's significant, but only at 90% in several cases there. So, just to sum up this micro paper, and I finished not badly to time, we're arguing that commercial property prices have got a major impact on a lot of performance variables of banks, and that the main theory that's justified, we think, is that it's a collateral theory, that financial accelerator or collateral effect, that the collateral is thought to by the banks to reduce risk and encourages them to lend. So prices go up, banks lend. And that holds across a number of econometric specifications. Some differences in small and large banks is that commercial property prices have got a smaller effect on the loan quality and the provisions of the small and the large, as I said. Also, their profits are less geared to commercial property prices than large. And that may be consistent with the large banks taking more risk because they know they'll be rescued, or they hope. And underlines the crucial relevance of commercial property prices as a macroprudential variable. So I guess the message for Estonia is it'd be good to find out if there are commercial real estate indices here. I mean, Jones, Lang and Wooten and these various companies do it for many countries. Maybe that's something you already know about, but data on prices is really crucial. And obviously that's even more difficult thing to do well than residential real estate because it's so heterogeneous, as I think you were saying. Also highlights the need to develop indicators of individual bank exposure for stress testing. So the challenge for supervisors, I think, is to say to banks, what is your exposure to commercial property? And it may even take them some time to work out what they've actually lent to commercial property, but the challenge that you might add to that then is, well, can you tell me your indirect exposures, for example, via collateral? Is your collateral going to disappear even on non-commercial property lending due to a downturn in commercial property? So that's the end of that. Any questions on that? Now we can talk in the coffee break and just relax for a while now. Yeah. So start again at 10:02 or thereabouts. Yeah.